Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this first hour. I'm going to focus this first hour a lot on the resource sector and a lot on some individual stocks. We're going to spend some more time on the stocks because I think now is a great time to take a look at everyone's portfolio and just make sure that you're positioned in stocks that look like they have catalysts and that you truly understand what they're going after. Because in all fairness, even though a lot of the juniors have been drifting over the last month or two, they're still well up from where they were 6 months ago. And maybe taking some profits, not a bad idea, but also understanding that news will continue to drive these stocks. I'm kicking off the show with Jote Mazumdar, editor of Exploration Insights. Jote, let's start off with your general comments on the precious metals sector. As I mentioned, gold, silver, they're a little bit off their highs, but overall, you look at something like gold and it's still had a very good year. How are you viewing the overall health of the precious metals sector?
Thanks again for having me, Corey. Yeah, the precious metal sector is doing really well, I would say, from the producer down to the explorer. I mean, the producers have obviously done well with much higher margin assets. You know, a lot of these majors are booking reserves at about 1,200, 1,250, and with a gold price, you know, over 1,900 or around 1,900, you know, that's almost at 2,000 at some point. The margins are there for them to generate significant free cash flow, as I pointed out to subscribers several weeks ago in the letter. But also their balance sheets are better. You know, the only issue is some that have been overexposed to Latin America have been impacted by suspension of mining activities due to COVID-19. But the rise in precious metals, gold and silver, has allowed them to generate more margin from the assets that are producing. That's somewhat mitigated any of those production losses. So the producers are doing well. The developers have been able, like the good developers I'd seen over the last 6 months, have been able to raise equity prior to actually getting their debt sorted out, which is, you know, a bit strange. Usually you get, you know, interest from the banks and then they put out, terms based on the fact that these guys, the company will end up with enough equity. But now the good ones already have that equity in hand. And, you know, one example for me would be Bluestone Resources with their Cerro Blanco project in Ecuador. I mean, they're financially supported by the Lundin Group, but in addition, they've been able to raise a significant amount of equity such that, you know, they could start, you know, basically, construction if they wanted to towards the end of the year, just on their equity and their next catalyst is to sort out the debt. So that's on the developing side. And then on the exploration side, we've seen, you know, $6 to $7 billion of recapitalization, you know, in Canadian terms, year to date in the mining, junior mining sector. And we've seen most of that directed at precious metals. So what comes out from this, you know, from the precious metals summit, you know, where I had about 40 meetings, is that, you know, having money right now is not a distinguishing feature with these juniors. Everyone seems to have money. Now it's about, what are you going to do with the money? And a lot of them are drilling, which is a positive, and so we should expect a lot of catalysts. But, you know, the opposite side of, you know, raising all that money is, you know, the valuations are getting a bit toppy, such that, you know, are we going to see a bit of a drop when the four-month hold of some of these private placements comes off towards the end of the year? That's a bit of a risk, but if you like the company, it might be an opportunity for you to pick up shares.
So how worried are you about that, Joe? In all fairness, I think we already have started to see some stocks drift lower because of, well, the shares that will become free trading, and also because of the fact that a lot of these financings are trading well above the financing price. So it is natural for these stocks to fade.
Yes, and yeah, that is a risk. I mean, I'm not worried about a lot of my companies just because I think that they're worthy assets, and you know, if they come down, then it might be an opportunity to pick up more. But if you pick up a levered story whose asset is a bit more shaky, you might be worried. You might be more worried, such that you know, it when it comes down, it might come down really hard and have very little support. What you'd want to see is that when it does come down, there's a lot of support. What we've seen in the financings that have been interesting, over the last several months is, you know, companies have cut back the demand. You know, it's not as if they had to, downsize their financings. The amount of oversubscribed upsized placements was significant on, a high proportion. They like to announce these upsize, oversubscribed. That might be a strategic thing by some of them. But a lot of them have left enough demand such that even after the placement's closed, it trades above or at a premium to the placement right away because there's just a lot more demand. And so when you're looking at your company that you bought, you know, look at how they actually structured the financing, were their warrants issued, you know. And so if you do have warrants or if it was flow through, you know, there's probably a higher risk that people will be selling at the end of the 4-month hold. If people raised, not a significant discount, you know, they've got a lot of money and they're drilling and that news flow is still coming, you know, there might be less of a risk that people might sell. Because the other problem, the issue is because of all that money that we've raised, you know, a significant amount of that's going in the ground, thankfully. But everybody's doing it at the same time, such that we've got, you know, an overflow at the assay labs because also the assay labs are, you know, are productivity challenged because of COVID. They can't have that many people in the lab. And that social distancing has made their productivity a lot less. So something that's rushed right now in terms of an assay that might have taken a week or two before is now taking about as long as a normal assay, you know, which might have been 2 to 4 weeks. Now, you know, people are talking 6 to 8 weeks with just, you know, a non-rush job. So we're going to see a lot of this news flow that's being generated through this field season in North America still coming out, you know, January, February next year.
Yeah, very true. I can't even count how many companies that I've talked to that have just said, look, assay labs are backed up and we're waiting on our drill results, but we don't really have much clarity as to when we're going to get those. It's really out of the company's hands. But Joe, as you even mentioned, a lot of money has been raised. A lot of drilling is happening. What has you excited about this drill season and potentially any results that you're watching for?
Well, I managed to pick up a few companies, you know, during the mid-March drop, and one of them that I've liked and, you know, have had as top pick was Liberty Gold, which is drilling this oxide, you know, open pit target in the Great Basin, in Idaho. And that one looks very interesting to me in terms of, you know, generating a potential resource that, you know, a mid-tier or a major might want, given its jurisdiction. You know, the metallurgy so far has been good, and the amount of gold and how it's dispersed within the favorable horizons there at Black Pine. So that's one I'm really excited about. They got 4 rigs on, but given, you know, the issue with the labs, there's no real point in adding more rigs because, you know, you're just going to delay everything even more. And so the problem with some of these, drill programs right now is that when you actually not only want the results to show your investors what you're doing, you also want the results, importantly, to find out where you're going to put more holes and drill more and focus. And that's getting a little bit more problematic now, such because it takes such a long time to get the drill assay results back. And so people have to more strategically plan their drill programs now because the results take a little bit longer to come in.
So is that shying you away from some of these more seasonal drill plays, like the one, say, in the Golden Triangle or even further north in Canada or Alaska, the fact that they're not getting their drill results back, so they are still, in a way, drilling blind? They can't use the prior results because they don't have them?
Yeah, it all depends on the type of deposit. The problem at Black Pine is it's Carlin style oxide. I mean, that's just what it is. But, you know, the whole idea with that gold is it's very, very fine, and you can't tell. You can tell the favorable lithology, the favorable alteration, but you can't tell if that's really high grade or moderate grade or low grade, because the gold's, you know, not visible to the eye, naked eye. Whereas in other areas, let's say high gold, which is up in Alaska, the gold, the precious metals there is associated with a lot of base metals. And so that's visual. So that's easy to know, okay, I've got to fast track this intersection because that's going to have a lot of grade. And so the more the gold is associated, or the mineralization that you're looking for has, you know, an association with, you know, massive sulfides or something like that, that's visual, whatever it is, and you've been able to define it, you know, you focus on this regardless. You would have an idea that this is what's going to run. It gets more problematic when you're looking maybe at an epithermal deposit and you go, well, you know, this is the texture I want, but I've been wrong before. You know, I'm not sure if this is going to be great. But if you've got the right texture, you're going to probably put another hole in that area, you know, but you may not know what the grade is. You know, I think when you're motivated by geology alteration and all that, you'll know where to put the holes, but you might not know if that's got the best grade right now because of the delay with the assays. You know, I don't have an issue in terms of saying, oh, I'm not going to buy this or I'm not going to buy that. I just have to understand the risks of you know, the news flow is going to be a lot slower.
Yeah, well, fair enough. And you know what? Eventually, we will see a lot of drill results and news coming out to the market. But right now, it seems like we're just getting a lot of exploration updates with companies telling us, look, they have drill core in the lab. They're just waiting for it. Joe, what about the balance between gold exploration, or gold juniors, let's call them, and silver stocks? Silver stocks really made a run as silver was moving higher, but when you compare how far off silver is from its all-time highs about a decade ago, and the fact that gold actually reached all-time highs just a month or two ago, the silver stocks, I think you can argue, really outperformed broadly the gold stocks.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, silver plunged even more during, you know, the March plunge in a lot of commodities. You know, we saw, you know, the gold to silver ratio go over 120. Now it's come back and moderated, I think, but, you know, 70 to 75 or something like that. And so that's a big jump in relative valuation. And that's, you know, driven by silver outperforming gold over that period. And the issue right now is, how do you get that silver exposure? And that's why companies like Silvercrest do so well, is because you're trying to look for a company with an asset that's got a lot of silver exposure, you know, like Mag Silver or something like that. It's harder to find that geologically. That, you know, because a lot of people use silver equivalents, but then you find out that, oh, silver is only 30% of that overall revenue. So if silver price goes up, they're not as exposed to that as, let's say, zinc or lead or copper or something else, you know. And a lot of the silver companies have converted to gold companies over the last 5 years because of, you know, it's harder to find these silver deposits, and silver hasn't done so well. And so there's very few out there that are very exposed to silver. I mean, one that I own, but it's a big company like Pan American Silver. I mean, despite the COVID issues with shutting down and suspending some operations, they've outperformed most of, you know, the 25 companies I looked as a cohort of precious metal producers, you know, since the middle March, you know, drop, you know, they provided a lot of leverage to the precious metals. And so, yeah, the issue is not that silver is doing well, is like, how do you expose yourself to it? And I've been having issues trying to find, you know, exposure like that in the juniors.
Joe, also, what about the balance between companies listed on the TSX or TSX Venture Exchange compared to Australian companies on the ASX? Because, again, these Australian companies have also outperformed broadly the Canadian companies.
Well, and they've outperformed because they've actually been finding things. You know, it's very discovery oriented exploration, and they've done really well. And that's been over the last 18 months, even before we've had them, you know, gold go up. We've seen a lot of, you know, high quality discoveries in Australia, Western Australia, Victoria, New South Wales, and, you know, a lot of places. And so I have begun to, you know, I've always owned ASX, and I've lived in Australia and worked there and did one of my masters there. So I'm quite comfortable with Australia, and I'm looking to expose my, you know, get more exposure in the portfolio to Australia. And I've picked up some Australian names that I know, where I know the people, like, you know, Stephen Nano, who was the ex-CEO of Mirasol. He's starting up a company called GBM Resources, which is looking at low sulfidation epithermal deposits in a known district in the Drummond Basin in Queensland. And so that is something I've invested in, because, you know, I like the people, I like the idea, low risk jurisdiction, no COVID issues with respect to generating news flow. They've raised money. And so I am doing some of that. And, you know, another one, a bigger market cap one that I got was, you know, Bellevue, which has got a really good deposit in Western Australia. And also, one of my better plays was actually a nickel thing in Vietnam, which was listed, which is listed in Australia, called Blackstone, which is BSX. So yes, I'm definitely have my eye consistently now on ASX listed companies, because the valuation is not so high prior to the discovery. And so there's not a lot embedded in there, and such that when they do make the discovery, that's when the pop is, not prior.
You're not too concerned about the share structure of these ASX listed companies? I know a lot of people were talking about that years ago, saying they just blow out their share structure, but it doesn't really seem to matter right now. Everyone's ignoring
No, you know, when we talk about share structure, my problem is not that some of these guys have 300 or 400 million shares out, but there's not people with 75 million shares that are priced at 0.05 cents. You know, and that's the problem with in Canada, is that you got all these structures where people, founder shares, or people have escrowed shares at, you know, at a very low cost. And those things come out in the market and they're continuously dumped into the market. And so whatever happens with the news flow, there's always people selling. And so, you know, I'm less concerned sometimes about the number of shares outstanding as about how much the cost of each share in there, you know, and it's more difficult for people to do that sort of thing on the ASX listed companies than what happens in Canada.
Joe, before we switch focus to another sector in terms of resource sectors, any other stocks that I assume you're, I guess, patiently waiting for in terms of news flow?
Oh, I mean, Corey, almost all of them. It's, you know, they've all got money and they're all sort of, you know, moving towards generating news flow. Some of them are hampered by the lab issue that we were talking about, but I mean, they're drilling, and so I'm patient on there. The ones that, you know, I've got more of an issue with, I guess, are the ones that are more exposed to Latin America or all in on Latin America, which I've sold a few of those, because, you know, COVID-19 it's just a bit risky in terms of not only getting permitting because the bureaucracy is delayed because of COVID-19 and everybody staying at home, but also drilling, getting people and stuff like that, or even exploring because of COVID-19, because, you know, you go to a remote place and they don't want you there and you shouldn't be there. Because they don't have any medical facilities or anything like that. The few companies I do own there are now permitted and now, you know, going to drill, you know, like Regulus in Peru, you know, but some other ones have had issues, like in terms of, you know, things that they would have liked to have been doing now, but can't.
All right. Well, Joe, one other sector that I do want to get your question or comments on is the battery metals sector, especially lithium too, because we had news that broke at the very beginning of the week about Tesla signing a contract with Piedmont Lithium for 5 years, potentially 10 years of supply from their North American operations in North Carolina. Do you see more interest coming into the battery metals because of this story or for any other reasons?
Yes, I mean, it'll certainly drive investor interest back into the lithium market when, you know, a big player like Tesla starts, you know, using their capital to invest in these little juniors. I mean, I've owned and sold Piedmont Lithium, but not at the price levels it is now. I was disappointed that they issued a lot of equity in earlier in the summer, you know, at a massive discount, and when I was waiting for a deal like this. So that was the issue for me. When I owned Piedmont, the idea was for them to generate a high margin product like lithium hydroxide, which is the product that's, you know, basically the one that's going to be used mostly in the new batteries and the NMC 811s over lithium carbonate. That's the high margin is generating lithium hydroxide. High margin is not generating a spodumene concentrate, which is what this will be. So, you know, a part of their plant or their proposed plant in the Carolina belt is going to be supplying Tesla, who are building the lithium hydroxide plant for their own batteries, because that really is the chemistry, that really is the difficult part of the equation, but that's also where the high margin comes in. Mining a high strip open pit that, you know, that grades head grade of 1 to 1.5% lithium oxide, and then upgrading it to a spodumene concentrate that's only 6%, and shipping it to Tesla is not, for me, in my opinion, a very high margin business plan. Granted, it's only a third of what they're thinking about doing, I believe, right now. But it gives them, you know, some of that mining output guaranteed, and gives them a name in the sector. So it's a big boon to them, considering that Albemarle and some other companies are in that district and never have made a deal with Tesla. So for Piedmont, that's definitely a big shout out to their management team to pull this off.
What about any other metals that do also get tied into this whole battery metal narrative?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think of it less as battery than greenhouse gas emission reductions. And so you could think of even palladium in there because of the catalytic converters. And before you get the penetration of the EVs or the electric vehicles, you know, you still have that imposition of reducing your emissions. And palladium is trying to fill that gap, and it may fill the gap longer if the EV penetration isn't that big. So I still like palladium. I like nickel, because that's becoming a higher loading in the ultimate battery that's gone from nickel manganese cobalt 111 to 8111, and might even be more nickel concentration. So that class one nickel, which is the nickel sulfide deposits, is what I'm focusing on, that and that's that project that in Vietnam with Blackstone, and also copper, because if you're doing all this electrification, that's the best conductor out there, and so copper is another one I'm constantly looking for. Hence, you know, the investments in Regulus and also things like Trilogy Metals.
All right, Joe, we're going to wrap it up there. We are out of time for this segment, but great having you back on the show, buddy. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend's show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I'll reach out to you, and I'll touch base in probably about a month's time. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.